And Ketitze, and it also says, fathers shall not be put to death because of sons, and sons shall not be put to death because of fathers. A man should be put to death for his own sin. And it says, in the plain sense of the verse, the Torah commands that parents not be killed or punished for the sins of their children, and vice versa.
Ketitze?
Yeah, that's right.
Where is that?
This is 24:16.
24:16. There's a chazal that says, Terem Machzeres Alachsanya Shalom. That the Terah returns to its host, to its hospitality. I mean, the chazal say that if he whose grandfather and whose father, whatever it is, if there are three generations who have studied Torah, so then it says that Terah comes back to that. Because Terah comes back to the place where it's been welcomed, place which has been hospitable to it. So Terah returns to its... The word for Asanya over here would be like if somebody came to visit a community and then was welcomed into somebody's house, that would be an Asanya. So if he then comes back and is welcomed back into that same place where he had been welcomed before, so that would be returning to his Asanya, would be returning to his host. So over here, the Chazal explains that if there are three generations that have studied Torah, so the Terah is Marzeres Alachsanya Shalom. Terah comes back to its Achsanya.
That's three successive generations?
Three successive generations. And I believe that this comment is accompanied by the comment, Achuta Meshulish the Bimheri Yenotek, that the thrice braided rope does not unravel. If you have something that's been braided for three generations, so now it's very stable, it's a very strong rope, so the Torah comes back to it. The implication, I think the popular understanding of this is that if you have successive generations that are accustomed to studying Torah, so then the fourth generation has it easy. The problem with that is that there are numerous other comments of a Chazal which contradict that, such that nobody has a free ride, and if a person does not toil in the study of Torah, then he does not acquire it, and it doesn't matter what happened before. And conversely, if somebody does toil in Torah, then he acquires Torah regardless of what transpired before. So some years ago, I commented on this by saying the following, that there are many Talmidei Chachamim who are really peerless Torah scholars. They are walking around with a command of Torah which is really extraordinary. And you can ask them anything, any place in the world, in within Shas, Yerushalmi, Bavli, Medroshim, everything. And yet somehow, regardless of this scholarship, there's no particular veneration that they enjoy. There's no particular following that they enjoy. People know that if you have a question, you can go ask them. These are not people who would be singled out as the Gedolei Yisrael. They're not seen as leaders of Klal Yisrael. And you have to ask yourself, how come? Here they are. They're the masters of all of this scholarship, all of this knowledge, and no one really recognizes them. They're not in any particular way acknowledged as people who are amongst the leaders of our people. There's a magnificent letter which is printed in the Kreine de Igris. It's I think there are two or three volumes, had a collection of letters, correspondence, that the Stipler had with hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people. You know, so they collected the letters. So there's a letter there that he wrote to Rabbi Chaim Kreisweert. Rabbi Kreisweert was the chief rabbi of Antwerp. Kreisweert.
With a K.
K. And he just passed away maybe 3-4 years ago. Had a photographic memory. Remembered everything. And it was a masterful orator. He really was a very exciting speaker. Anyway, so he was deeply respectful of the Stipler and wanted very much that the Stipler should come to Antwerp. He apparently tried to prevail on him to come, and the Stipler didn't want to come, so the Stipler wrote him a letter, which is an absolutely precious letter, in which he says to him, there's no point in my coming. Your purpose in my visit would be so that, apparently this is what he expressed to him, he wanted that the people of Antwerp should see a God will be so, they should, he said, you know, he said, like, I really don't qualify for any of the things that you wanted me to come, he said, and he said, people have this impression of me that I'm a Torah scholar, he said, and he said, I'm really not. He said, everything that I've written about, he said, I worked so hard, I toiled so hard, he said. He said, people are going to come, they're going to ask me questions, he says, and I don't really know the answers. He said, it's going to be a big disappointment. Anyway, it's written with such... It's so genuinely humble. I mean, you know, it's a moving letter. My experience in my many travels is that I've been hosted by many wonderful people. They've given me the finest accommodations, beautiful accommodations. And they've tried very hard to make me comfortable. But I discovered very interesting things. People make you comfortable in the ways that they're comfortable. So, I'd come to, to breakfast, and they would put down the breakfast they're comfortable. It happens to be that none of the things that they like for breakfast are on my interest list. I don't have any. They put down these weird things to it. And I'd have to do my best, to find something that I could eat and what's more compliment them on. The room would be either too hot or too cold, according to their taste. The bed would be either too hard or too soft because that's what they liked. And invariably, the pillow was never the right kind of pillow. So it was a wonderful lasagna, right? It was a wonderful hospitality. It just wasn't mine. It wasn't, they all meant well. And they were very respectful, but it didn't really make me. I'm comfortable when I go to my kids. My kids know exactly what it. So they'll come running with a, they know the exact pillow that I'm comfortable with. You know that have, you know, what kind of a breakfast. But then it's right. Uh-huh. That's my achsanya. Right? So I suggested that there are lots of people who have Torah. But it's not Torah Zachsanya because they're either arrogant and full of themselves, or they're the Torah that they've studied was not approached with a great deal of either fear and trembling of heaven or someone who sat down and said, I want to study this Torah because this is this is how I'm going to come to love Hashem. So that was, it was an academic study. And if it's an academic study, that's precisely the way it comes down. And when you see a person who studied academically, what you see is a computer. You know, it's got, he's got all the information. He's a library. But that's not Torah Zachsanya. Torah Zachsanya is a person who has studied that, who approached it because he yearned for Hashem. A person who has that kind of humility that you see emanating from a stipler. That's the kind of thing that lives in a person who's got Mesiris Nefesh for another Jew. It's a whole different thing. Many years ago, I've mentioned this incident to you. I spoke to a convention of Reform rabbis. So, in the course of this, I told them how they had crafted a catastrophe. That by doing all of the things that they're doing, they're dividing the people. They're coming up with patriarchal, patrilineal descent, and are absolutely contemptuous of our laws of conversion or divorce. I said to them, "You're making it so that we're not going to, a generation from now, we're not going to know who is and who is not Jewish, who is a child of a kosher marriage and who is a mom. We're not going to know any of this stuff." I said to them, "What you're making it is that we will become two nations and there will be, we won't be able to intermarry." I said, "You're the architect of a catastrophe. You're dividing us." So Arnold Wolf was his name? Arnold Wolf was there. He was a very articulate fellow and a brilliant writer. And a soul in transition. Anyway, so he got up and he said to me, "You're not being entirely fair to us." He said, "We are concerned about women's rights, women's equality. The Shulchan Aruch says that a woman can have an aliyah. And you're not offering that. So you're not even operating within realm of." So I said to him, "If somebody were to bring a computer in that had all of Torah in it, I would not stand up for the computer. I wouldn't rise in front of that computer." I said to him, "Torah knowledge is not what makes the difference. What makes the difference is someone who has absorbed the Kedusha of Torah into themselves in such a way that they have become a Torah." I said to him, "And that requires that a person feel a sense of responsibility to Jewish history, all of the dedication and devotion and martyrdom and self-sacrifice that brought this generation to a point where they could be Jewish in these very, very trying times." And I said, and those people who have a sense of obligation and responsibility to the future. So they have a vision of, if what we do right now has to be viable so that it's going to make it possible that 10 generations from now, they're going to be Jews. Mm-hmm. So I said to him, "We don't ask questions of, it says in Shulchan Aruch that a woman can have an aliyah, but it's not done because of covered that too, but Shulchan Aruch says it's not done." I said to him, "So you want to dispense with whatever it is, the cover that tzibur, whatever that is, and you want to say the Shulchan Aruch is okay, so we're going to give women aliyahs." I said, "That may make sense to you right now." I said, "What are the ramifications of giving women aliyahs on what our wives and mothers are going to be like 2 generations from now, 4 generations from now? Are we confusing roles? Are we distorting the kind of definition that wives and mothers are going to have in Judaism?" I said, are you being responsible? He said, "You're being responsible to right now." I said, "But are you being responsible to the future?" I said, "The only people we can ask those questions of are people who have acquired Judaism with that sense of responsibility, who've paid the price for their beliefs in 1,000 different important ways, and who have that kind of of sense of accountability to the future. So I said to him, you're right, it does say in Shulchan Aruch that that's a possibility, with the exception of a problem called a tzibur. I said to him, but our Gedalei HaTorah have said that this is not a responsible move for the destiny of our people, so we don't do it. The point over here is that when we say Torah Machzeres Machsanya Shelah, the word we have to emphasize over here is Shelah. Torah comes back to its Machsanya. There are many people walking around who have the information of Torah, but there's no guarantee over here that the generations that succeed them will have a clue about where it's at, because their midos and their character has been one that has not paid attention to where is Tera comfortable. You got all the, put on the right breakfast, they have all the nice accommodation, but it's not, Tera's not comfortable, because Tera is comfortable in those surroundings where there is humility, where there's Mesiras Nefesh, where there's a sense of the past, a sense of the future. There's a whole cluster of things. So I said the bottom line is that the Archachamim are not trying to tell us that anybody ever has an easy ride with the acquisition of Torah. You can have 17 generations before you that have studied Torah. It's not going to make any difference if you don't work hard. And if you do work hard, even if you don't have the 17 generations, what it's telling you is that if you have the benefit of three generations of people who have been a real achsanya for Torah, they've made Torah comfortable, then you have an example that you're not likely to be able to ignore. And those characteristics will be accessible to you in a way so that when you study Torah, Torah will be
comfortable.
Will be comfortable. Having said that, when you have successive generations that have developed characteristics that are impervious to Torah, if you have successive generations that have renounced Torah values, so each generation is responsible only for its own wrongdoing, and the fourth generation or the fifth generation is also going to be only responsible for its wrongdoing. But the Rebbeinu Shlomo is forbearing. He's tolerant. He's a nice, the first generation, the second generation, third generation. But when you reach the fourth generation, then the Ben Shalom says, what's the point of my tolerance over here? My tolerance is that I believe they're going to do tshuva. My tolerance is that they're going to wake up and smell the coffee or whatever you end up. After four generations of people who are contemptuous of Torah, whose character is shaped by this feeling of rejection, the fourth generation, I'm not going to wait with the fourth generation. The fourth generation will pay for its sins, not going to pay for their sins, it'll pay for its own sins, but it will pay for its sins in a not forbearing way, because of the sins of the fathers,
for which he had greater forbearance and greater tolerance.
Right. So it's not the issue over here is not that anybody is going to pay for anybody else's sins. The way in which they will pay for the sins of the previous generations is only in the fact that there's no point in forbearance. There's no soil over here.
It's not cushion.
Right.